staff will support you.
So many things we like best are golf,
doing crafts,
hanging with friends,
and gardening.
I like doing everything at EAF. We just love extended family.
Visit us at www.efkingston.com.
Come on down to EFK, located at 660 Baggett Street, for a great time. Be a part of our extended family.
Come to extended family. Come and have some fun.
Okay, we're here. CFRC 101.9 FM. My name's Rue. We're back for another CFRC live session, and I'm joined today by a fellow CFRC volunteer. Hello. Hi. Richard.
Hello. It's so great to be here. Oh my gosh.
I know, we're so excited to have you. I think we should start off by letting you introduce yourself to our listeners, because I think they've had a lot of acoustic, folk, guitar-based stuff, and today they're going to hear something very different.
Yeah, so I'm Richard. I also go by the name Forged Rains. That's my producer name. I also host Harder Clip here on CFRC Fridays at 8 p.m., where you're going to hear kind of a lot of rave music, like hardcore, hard style, but even more some of like more esoteric styles around what we call like the doujin music community, where it's very indie. There's a lot of focus on like indie.
Indie in the sense of independent.
Independent, right. Not as in like the kind of conceptions that we have of like indie music here in Canada anyway, because a lot of this music does come from like parts of Asia, specifically like Japan, where it does like originate from. And it does have like a lot of roots in like rhythm game music, like kind of Dance Dance Revolution or like Beatmania, that kind of stuff. Maybe Osu as well, like very in terms of like modern day kind of stuff. I say is of like DDR, it's not modern, but like, you know, kind of 90s, 80s kind of stuff. But yeah, so today I'll be like at least showing a bit of that. But mostly kind of the music that inspires me and what I create, at least in what can be roughly described as doujin music. But I thought I would start off with some, you know, Monster Cat, if anyone recognizes. I feel like within like the mid to 2010s, they were really prolific in like EDM spaces. And now they're kind of like more mainstream than I would consider what they were before, at least. But kind of a little bit of a throwback.
So is this tonight also the sort of stuff, like what you're going to be playing today, is that also similar to what people would hear on Harder Clip?
So some of it. There's definitely like a lot of overlap with like Western music styles in terms of like drum and bass, UK hardcore, like psytrance as well has been like I find has been like kind of becoming more popular recently, even with some more niche genres like high tech and full on. But there will be some of that, and also as well as some of my own music. Yeah.
Perfect. So like, do you have a track name or something? Like, what's the vibe of the first set? Because you said that we're gonna have a few shifts in between,
right? So these first few tracks are going to be more like electro house kind of oriented. We are going to like open up with like a drum step track. I did try and like pull tracks that I thought influenced my own music styles, or the music that I create anyway, kind of like building up like the foundations of what I consider to be my own taste, at least. But yeah,
and I think for some of our listeners, you might have to explain electro house a little bit, so
right,
let's do that quickly.
so electro house is like a subgenre of house music where it's kind of a lot of focus on like synthesized sounds and kind of complex like bass patterns, rather than kind of like more kind of vibey stuff. I think it's definitely more upbeat, even though the tempo is like this similar.
Less ambient.
Yes, exactly. Kind of a lot of like sound design elements of like synthesizers, you know, if anyone knows, like Serum, definitely very much used. And now like there's a whole bunch of new virtual synthesizers that are definitely being used. But yeah.
So let's go into your first your first set.
Yeah.
Okay, here on CFSC Live Sessions.
Thank you. moaning.
This is Richard here at 101.9 CFRC.
Yeah, welcome back. We're back on the CFRC Live Sessions. Richard, you're joining us for Drains, if people want to check you out. So how did you get started with like electronic kind of music?
Yeah, so the kind of first exposure I've had to like electronic dance music in particular, it was actually like Minecraft YouTubers.
Okay.
Like, you know, when they would have like the really like, you know, early 2010s, like, animated opening with like their name bouncing around it to like some like electronic beat.
Mm-hmm.
I actually like went ahead and like looked up like some of the artists that were like making these tracks. One of which was, his name was like Approaching Nirvana, I believe. And that kind of like started my foray into like the wonders of like electronic dance music. And then from there I kind of started listening to like Monster Cat, as some of the tracks I've played definitely were very like formative memories of mine. And then I didn't really dive more into like producing until after I started like playing like rhythm games on like my phone. The first one I started playing was actually called Situs, Situs.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's like one of the most popular like mobile rhythm games there is. And then from that, there was like all of the music in that game, there's like kind of this like homemade flavor to it, if
DIY,
that makes any sense. DIY kind of, yeah. And then like I later find out that's like called like doujin music, because a lot of the musicians are like from Japan, and it started this whole like rabbit hole of like discovering like the doujin music community. And I also at some point realized like I can start making music like this. So, you know,
that's kind of where the DIY touch comes
in. Exactly.
Like it feels like anyone can do it then.
Yeah, it's like definitely like, you know, very much bedroom producer, like cracked DAW kind of beginnings, right? And then you kind of explore more, because it's a very like grassroots community, I find. Because they also, there's like this like emulator of like an arcade rhythm game called, what was it called? It's like the BMS community is what they'd call it. And like they held these events where basically people create original music and they would create their own like rhythm game, like charts, or like levels basically to each song.
Okay.
And it's, you know, very like tight-knit community, and I kind of like dabbled in a bit there, but it's like very tedious, and usually people have like a team responsible for like different elements of like, you know, someone's responsible for like a background animation, someone's like responsible for making the actual chart itself, someone's in charge of making the music, and like it's like a very team effort kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a full house production.
Yeah, like no joking. But from there I basically kind of was exploring like the different communities that like sprouted from like BMS in particular, where like a lot of these artists later go on to like join like various like dance labels in Asia, and like even go on to start their own labels. There's like this really big one called Hardcore Tanosi, based in Japan, and they have some of like the really big like hard dance producers from Japan. And like I myself too, also like I'm involved with some like Chinese dance music labels, like very like small scale ones, but it's still very like there's still that element of like homemade to it all, you know?
Yeah, and it's also like a very global community, because so much of it, like you said, comes from online like meetups.
Yeah, like we have some like the more famous like rhythm game producers are from all over the world. We have some from France, we have some from Mexico, a lot of places from like Southeast Asia as well, like Indonesia. I know there's some like there's like various circles from around there as well. Korea, you know, Korea, China, Japan, East Asia. But there's also like I don't know, to me it's just such a nice thing to like know that there's like people around the world that have like the shared goal of just, you know, making great music.
Yeah, absolutely. And then how did you like you start online, and then when did you get more involved with like releasing stuff? Because you said that you worked with labels and things like that, and you've been like here as well, like playing kind of some of the more experimental shows around Kingston, and we'll talk about Kingston in just a
right.
bit.
Yeah. Label wise it's still very much like based online. But I'm definitely looking into more like kind of homegrown stuff, like Kingston and also Toronto, where like I'm originally from, and like playing like live shows, like at least dipping my toes into like some of that. It's definitely a part of that, where you're kind of like growing like a community at home. It's like grassroots community. That's like the heart of like doujin music, basically. Yeah.
And then from all these different places around the world to Kingston.
Yeah.
How have you found like the scene at Kingston and Queens kind of to an extent has been for you? Because like you're in the music department as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Queens wise in like the music department, I've definitely had the fortune of having very supportive like peers and professors, at least. And I've also found like a new home here at CFRC as well. Like, you know, people
hey.
Who just love good music. And
yeah, there are also like shows at the station. Like some of the shows that you've played have been like No Static shows,
mm-hmm.
the Next Church kind of shows that Mikey puts on.
Yeah. Me and Mikey, we even like the other day, like we with like a whole like car full of people, we like literally drove to Ottawa.
I remember that.
And then like we and attended a punk show in like someone's basement. It's just like, that's my first ever punk show. It was amazing.
Wow.
I loved it.
Do you feel that's going to seep into your music now?
Oh, definitely.
I'd love to hear that.
I love it.
But in Kingston, it's a very small scene. But again, like you said, the global scene also is very small and very like well connected, in the sense that like everyone kind of knows everyone. So how have you found it in Kingston?
Yeah, in Kingston specifically, at least with like regards to like the kind of hardcore, more like harder styles and like underground styles of music, I think I just really haven't found like the people. Like yet at least to kind of help kind of foster a community at least more geared toward that kind of stuff, which could be like a thing on me, just like maybe not like taking the initiative to actually go out to live shows, which I like definitely feel like I will be doing more in the future. But yeah, electronic music wise, kind of harder styles, at least it's not really found a footing here in Kingston yet, I believe. Anyway,
there are tiny little things popping up, but I think something still needs to pull them all together.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
But it's coming together, and you know, this is kind of almost a call out for anybody that wants to get involved. There are people at the station in Kingston who are really like looking for those other people to kind of come together and form that community. Mm-hmm. So that's a call out right there.
Yeah.
So tell us about your second set, because we'll go into some more music now.
So we're gonna start off with some like psytrance tracks, which is one of my personal favorite genres. I just kind of like the sound of the rolling bass, and it's just very like, you know, it's very satisfying to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're gonna transition into some harder styles of music, like hard style. Yeah.
Okay, so this one is gonna pick up in pace slowly.
Real fast. Yeah. Going from 128 to like 140, 150, 60.
That's a workout.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to it right now here on CFRC.
Yeah. concert.
Live sessions. Thanks so much to Forged Rains for joining us in studio for this wonderful rave set. You can find his work on Bandcamp at Forged Rains, forgedreigns.bandcamp.com. We'll see you next week for another live session. See you next Thursday at 11 a.m.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints on today's show. A journalism meeting in Montreal was hampered by visa issues after six of their guests were denied entry.
There is a war on journalists. I mean, we've seen hundreds of journalists being killed in Gaza who are trying to report out the news. There's an active effort to sue organizations, news organizations, to undermine them, to try and discredit them.
This as many Canadian activists were detained in Egypt during the March to Gaza event last weekend.
So we are in the checkpoint and they're pulling people to go to the buses. Canadian people, we stick together, please.
We also will tell you a bit more about ourselves. Frequency News published its 5,000th story this week.
I just feel like I have a better sense of what Canada is because I'm going to a different place every day.
And I think the other thing is that we get to see the similarity between stories all across the country.
Summer's for many of us gardening time. In Fredericton, there's more demand for garden plots than there is available space.
This garden has 77 plots. The other garden has over 100. We were full, completely full. By the end of April, we had nothing left.
And a feel-good story for us. A Tantramar High School student raised $30,000 to build solar panels for his school. Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints. Boris assigned with you for the next 30 minutes. Well, on last week's show, we aired a story about Canadian activists, including Montrealers, who were on their way to Egypt to take part in the global march to Gaza. Thousands from around the world planned to march from Cairo to the border of Gaza in Egypt near Rafah City. Organizers say the march was intended to be a symbolic movement, demanding Israel end its blockade of international aid to the Gaza Strip. However, between June 11th and 13, 74 Canadians were detained by authorities in Egypt, alongside thousands of other activists from around the world, before they could even begin their scheduled global march to Gaza. Adam Innes sat down with activists Ricardo Flores and Tatiana Harker. Flores was one of the Canadians detained by the Egyptian police. He made it back to Montreal. Harker was the organizer for the Canadian delegation who has overseen the return of Canadians. This story was first aired on June 18.
Free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
This is audio obtained by CJLO from activists detained in Egypt. Thousands are seated on the ground and held for hours by Egyptian police in video attached to this audio. Activists say they were detained, pushed onto buses, many were handcuffed, and almost all had their passports confiscated. At the time of this report, organizers say 40 Canadians have been able to return to Canada safely, 20 are on their way home, and 14 Canadians are still stuck in Egypt, with little contact between them and friends and family back in Canada. Ricardo Flores is one of the Canadians who has arrived back here in Montreal. He sat down with CJLO to describe some of the chaos that went on.
We just realized how the Egyptian authorities work out to dissolve demonstrations. It was applied to us. It's like people without any kind of identification, with long sticks, hitting people sitting down on a grass, just to force them to move. It was very violent situation and without any kind of control from our side.
Tatiana Harker is a member of Vivre Palestine Montreal and one of the coordinators of the March to Gaza. Harker organized the Canadian delegation of the march and has been instrumental in helping the Canadians return home. She was in Montreal when the delegation was detained. Harker says that she received little to no assistance from the Canadian embassy in Cairo.
It's been 3 days we had contacting them, you know, so it's very disappointing. We contact them, we call them, everything. They never show up. For 3 days, they never show up. And then on the weekend, they say like, oh, it's the weekend, we're closed. Yeah, but on Friday, you never show up either. On Wednesday, you never show up either. On Thursday, either.
The Embassy of Canada to Egypt in Cairo would not respond to CJLO for comment. Global Affairs Canada provided references to their travel advisory, which warns Canadians to avoid all travel to the northern Sinai area of Egypt, where the detainment took place. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
You're tuned to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
The International Federation of Journalists annual meeting in Montreal was also last week. It was hampered by visa issues. That's because six of their journalists from Angola, Cameroon, Peru, Colombia, Panama, and Palestine could not make it because Canada refused to approve their visas. Many members of the Federation were in Montreal on June 11 and 12 as part of their ongoing efforts to strengthen protections for reporters in light of the profession's growing threats. The IFJ is, by the way, the largest organization of journalists, representing 600,000 media professionals in more than 140 countries. It says it was the first time they'd seen so many refusals from a democratic country like Canada. Jules Bugiel has that story.
The International Federation of Journalists met in Montreal last week. They work to strengthen protections for journalists worldwide. But the group's leadership say that work was made more difficult after Canada blocked visas for six journalists on the executive committee.
It's completely incomprehensible. I didn't think Canada would do a thing like this.
This is IFJ Secretary General Anthony Bélanger speaking at a press conference on Wednesday. He expressed shock that the journalists didn't get approved. The six hailed from Angola, Cameroon, Peru, Colombia, Panama, and Palestine.
It's the first time we've had so many refusals. We sometimes have refusals, but not by countries like Canada.
The IFJ executive numbers around 24 journalists from around the world. They and observers were meeting in Montreal to discuss the threats facing those in the profession, which they say are on the rise. They condemned Israel's treatment of journalists in particular. The IFJ says Israel has killed 170 journalists, mostly Palestinian, since October 7th. The country has also prohibited international journalists from entering Gaza. In that context, Bélanger said it was all the more disappointing not to hear firsthand from IFJ Vice President Nasser Aboubakar, a Palestinian living in the West Bank who had gone through bureaucratic hoops to apply for his visa to Canada, including paying hundreds of euros and spending the night at the Israeli border, just to be refused.
Et c'est ça la réalité d'un Palestinien.
That's the reality of being Palestinian. Even a leader, a journalist. It's a real scandal. We don't go through all of this just for show.
When reached for comment, Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship Canada said they lacked the approval to comment on the refusals due to privacy concerns. The IRCC's actions come at a time when journalists are in danger. John Schlois is president of News Guild CWA, an American union representing some 28,000 journalism workers. He spoke to the IFJ executive about threats to journalists in the United States and how they connect to what's happening worldwide.
There is a war on journalists. I mean, we've seen hundreds of journalists being killed in Gaza who are trying to report out the news. We have tons of journalists who have been killed in Latin America, particularly in Mexico. And we are seeing Trump's rhetoric, right, going from the enemy of the people to action, where there's an active effort to sue organizations, news organizations, to undermine them, to try and discredit them, and to also bring in the police to be more aggressive on journalists who are just trying to cover events happening in our cities.
At their meeting in Montreal, the IFJ passed a motion condemning U.S. law enforcement's treatment of journalists at anti-deportation protests in L.A. earlier this month. That treatment included shooting journalists with tear gas, rubber bullets, and less lethal munitions. The IFJ says they're also working on an international convention to keep journalists safe, one that would require real buy-in from countries and real consequences if it's broken.
We'll fight to make sure that journalists are able to do their jobs, because at the end of the day, journalists have to be the ones who are holding a mirror to the rest of the world, holding power to account.
So this story was produced by Jules Bugiel, based in Montreal. And we're not only playing it because it's a good story. It's also the number 5,000 story published on frequencynews.ca since Frequency launched on December 2023. Over that time span, as many as 85 reporters have contributed articles to frequencynews.ca, while dozens have also done so on our French counterpart, fréquenceinfo.ca. Our English team, spread out across about 20 communities in 8 provinces, has been hard at work. Who better to talk about this milestone than Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox, both of our national editors. Hi, how are you?
Hello, Boris.
Great, thank you.
Victoria, you've seen every one of these 5,000 stories pass by your eyes and ears. You've been with Frequency News for more than 2 years now, I think, no?
That's right. I was not working with the Radio Fund with the Local Journalism Initiative at the very beginning. Our colleague Maureen McEwen was there in the beginning until she moved on in September 2024. So in the time when we launched the new website, because there was another website before that called Canada Info. .ca. Lots of good stories there too, but the 5,000 are the ones that have been published on the new site. Yes, indeed, there's a great variety there, and it's been wonderful to read them and work on them and talk to our journalists. So it's been great.
Yeah, so Maureen left in September, last September, and that's when you, Conrad Fox, joined us in October of 2024.
That's right, Boris. Getting to the 5,000. Well, I have to admit that I didn't even know we were getting close to 5,000 until last week when Victoria slacked me and said, hey, check out the story count. And I was like, oh, my God. And I have to admit, I've only been there for, what, maybe 1,000 of them or so. But it's been really fun. Yeah, it's been really exciting.
What do you appreciate the most by working with all these journalists and seeing all these stories being published?
There are so many things that I appreciate, but I would say the big one is I feel like I'm connected with so many places in Canada. I've learned things about communities that, you know, I wouldn't have known otherwise. I mean, who knew it's been taking so long to get a pool in Liverpool, for example. And we've had like some really, really good in-depth sort of examinations about the forest fires. That's, you know, not good news, but yet at the same time, it's important news. And so I just feel like I have a better sense of what Canada is because I'm going to a different place every day.
And I think the other thing is that we get to see the similarity between stories all across the country. So, you know, these may be fairly small issues, at least within the community. So let's say, I don't know, a food bank closing, you know, this affects people in the local community. But we, as editors, we're kind of in a privileged position to see this happening in Glace Bay, and then it happens in Smithers. And we get, you know, all of these kind of like similar experiences that for the people in the communities, they may feel like they're the only people that are going through them, but we can see that they're happening all across Canada, and not just the negative stories too, of course, like the really positive ones, like building community gardens or as Victoria says, building a swimming pool, so important to Canadians all across the country.
And we should also note that Jules Bigel was also recently nominated as a finalist at the RTDNA Canada Awards for a story she produced last year for this show, Viewpoints, and of course for her Montreal stations, KUTFM. It was a 23-minute documentary on urban agriculture. It's a good year for Jules Bigel.
It is. And, you know, I've got to say, when I first heard her documentary, I was really thrilled by it because, I mean, I'm a farm kid. I grew up on a farm, and the whole thing about how agriculture is changing and why we need our city spaces as well to produce agriculture and food. I love the story, but the way she treated it in particular, like we went on a tour of Montreal and all of these different spaces, there's lively sound. I felt like I was actually there, sort of on a little bus going along with them from different locations to different locations.
Mm-hmm. We were able to take that story and play it to other reporters all across the country.
Yeah,
and I think exactly. It's actually served as kind of inspiration. So we've actually got a few more stories in the pipeline about community gardens and about, you know, like urban environments.
Well, congratulations to you both and to all your team. Keep up the good work. I hope you celebrate it as you should.
Thank you.
Thank you, Boris.
Bye-bye.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
Thank you, Maureen McEwen. And now on to our next story and to Fredericton, where community gardens are as popular as ever. The president of the Fredericton Organic Community Garden, Heather Agrican, says that more than 40 people are still waiting for their plot. And Carol Munzer agrees, as she now has to turn people away from their gardens. She's youth and family educator for the New Brunswick Community Harvest Gardens. We spotted journalist Aidan Keenan in Fredericton walking around one of them. He brought this back to us.
Do you know what? This is my first time looking after it.
Peony.
So got peonies and a stilby. There's a kind of a lily there.
I would say.
I'm waiting for things to come up.
This spring, community gardens in Fredericton have seen an unprecedented increase in interest. Almost every community garden in the city is fully booked with a wait list. This newfound interest is an increasing trend that's hit its peak in 2025. Here's Heather Grieken, the president of the Fredericton Organic Community Garden.
So over the last 12 months, we've seen an increase in requests for plots, especially since we are number two for food insecurity in Canada at 22.7%, I think. We have expanded twice. This year, we could have expanded a third time, but we're just going to stay with what we have and hopefully get everyone, as many people on the wait list, off the wait list and into the garden.
That wait list is one of the biggest changes facing community gardens in Fredericton this year.
When I talked to Carol from MB Community Harvest, when we first started, between the two of us, we had close to 43 each of people that we didn't think we'd be able to accommodate, which is huge for us.
Carol Munzer, the youth and family educator for New Brunswick Community Harvest Gardens, echoed Heather's sentiments.
We were nearly full at the end of March. We've never, ever had to say to someone, we don't have a plot for you. This garden has 77 plots. The other garden has over 100. We were full, completely full. By the end of April, we had nothing left.
Heather expanded on why she thinks there's been such an increase in interest this year.
Food prices, that's the biggest thing. Working at Scott's Nursery, I work in the vegetable section during the season, the seasonal work, and I find a lot of people are skipping the flowers this year and putting food in. People want to grow their own stuff, and it goes from they're little mini farmers, they want to be mini farmers and take it straight to their table. So, and again, it is cost. I mean, you just have to go and look at the price of a small package of tomatoes, and you can understand why people want to grow their own.
Carol elaborated on some of the deeper concerns that might drive people to grow their own food.
COVID, I think, woke up a lot of people, and people are frightened. What's going to happen? Is the food chain going to collapse? Is the delivery system going to collapse? And so it's one thing to say, yes, we can import what we need, but I think people are starting to say the closer to home we can buy our food, grow our food, the safer we are, because we know that it is going to be there. We're not going to go hungry. We've been woken up. And with all the tariff problems and stuff happening south of the border, I think it's made it even worse. People are really, really getting very concerned about where their food is coming from.
Aaron Sharp, a member of the Fredericton Organic Community Garden, described how those considerations factored into her decision to start gardening.
I grew up gardening as a kid. I'm in the environmental field, so I know a fair bit about plants and whatnot. But I live in an apartment, so I needed a place to grow food because I enjoy it, and it's a big therapy thing for me, but absolutely to supplement groceries. I definitely love being able to grow my own food, knowing where it came from, knowing that it's not sprayed, and also reducing my greenhouse gas emissions by not having it shipped in and whatnot from other areas.
Increased demand for garden plots also means that wider demographics are getting their hands in the soil.
We're getting a lot more of the newcomers, and we've always had a lot of newcomers through the Multicultural Association. I am finding we're getting some younger families. I don't have actual numbers on that, but I just get the gut feeling. It used to be all a few young families, and they would come, learn how to garden, then buy a house and go home and garden in their own backyard. And now what's happening, I think rents are so high that people are having a hard time making that step to go buy their own house where they can garden in their backyard.
Here's Sean Meister, who joined the Fredericton Organic Community Garden with his wife Beth only a few years ago.
So we started doing some gardening on our patio of our apartment first. Flowers and herbs, and I had some experience with that growing up. We heard about this place. It wasn't far away from where we live, so we came here and made some friends and meet some new people. There's a lot of new Canadians here as well, so that's kind of fun talking to everybody because they grow things that they're used to eating and stuff we never see before.
Beth shared another reason that she started gardening.
Well, part of the thing was I had a mini stroke, and then we found this opportunity, and I was looking for things that I was able to do while I was still coming back and doing occupational therapy, and community garden's really good for your soul.
Like watching things grow that you care for, it's good for your mental health. It just feels good.
Luckily, community gardens are just the place for new gardeners to hone their green thumb.
What we do is when they fill out the application, we ask them if they would like to be partnered up with a more seasoned gardener. So if they want to, then they'll partner up with someone, we'll give them someone to talk to, and they'll mentor them through the process until they get more comfortable in the garden. I'm mentoring someone. Most of the executive committee who are seasoned gardeners are mentoring someone. And then they can take that knowledge and pass it on to someone else.
Carrie Sumner, who has a plot at the St. Mary's Church Garden organized by NB Community Harvest, is a prime example of that community tutoring process.
Well, I've been here since we dug the first hole, so I was part of the group that started all the digging. I'm a teacher. I just retired last year. So a lot of the knowledge I built up here, I took back to the school and into the classroom. So we did a lot of growing in school, and I actually developed two great big vegetable garden plots there for the kids, and then got involved in the food forest there at school. So it just was sort of like a domino effect. I started digging a hole here to help them get the garden going, and now I consider myself a gardener.
Carrie finished by describing how the garden has grown both food and community.
You know, the first couple of years, you had little conversations, but now, especially the people that have been coming over the years, it's really truly become a community garden. Whereas before, yes, it was called a community garden, but I really feel the community sense of it now. When everybody, you know, we kind of give each other tips or say, oh, I tried this last year, didn't work for me. And then, you know, you'll have these conversations. So it's very, very social.
I'm Aidan Keenan for the Local Journalism Initiative.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
Oi, meu amor. Tá me ouvindo? Você tá dormindo? Tem uma coisa importante que eu queria te contar. Mas eu tô com medo que meu coração silencie meus lábios. Às vezes, à noite, quando eu escuto a sua respiração, eu imagino que é o mar, que essa cama é um barco, e você é o oceano me carregando.
And we close this edition of Viewpoints in Sackville. That's where a grade 11 Tantramar Regional High School student has become the driving force behind a fundraising campaign that could see a school producing some of its own power with a new solar panel array this year. Josh Mullen has secured $30,000 in funding to go towards a solar array that he hopes TRHS students may be able to participate in installing. Erica Butler met up with him a few weeks ago and started by asking him more about himself.
I'm Josh Mullen. I'm a grade 11 student at Tantramar Regional High School, and my biggest interests are I play sports, soccer, hockey, and golf, and I also love doing video games, my hobbies, and other stuff, also environmental stuff as well. I love that. It's kind of like one of my biggest passions. Yeah.
Now tell me about this project that you've been working on, solar panels.
Yeah, so it started about around last summer. A friend of mine, Quinn McCaskill, she is an alumni of Tantramar Regional High School, and she graduated the past year. And when she went to my school, she was a big leader at our school for environmental awareness and stuff like that. And she would do all these crazy stuff, and it really kind of got me thinking about it and kind of inspired me pretty much. And later on in the summer before my grade 11 year, she reached out to me with an email and told me about this grant that was willing to fund students and youth involved that in any environmentally friendly project that could help the earth, but it was also part of your school and that was kind of run by youth. Essentially, she showed that to me, and that got me really excited. So I got thinking from there, and solar panels eventually popped into my mind. Went crazy, I guess. I talked to my principal, and then we got the funding from our first funders. There was three in total now, but our first was a group called Now for Net Zero, and they gave us, I think we asked for $5,000 initially. Eventually, they gave us around 20,000 or 15,000, something between that area.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really great. Yeah.
And so how much funding are you up to now?
We're around $30,000 right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, wow. So when will this project happen?
Well, installation, we're hoping to aim for maybe like late summer, early fall. Hopefully fall, because that would allow for us to get more student involvement probably. And one of the biggest goals actually of this project is to get kids who are looking to get into like the electrical career when they're older, and it would hopefully give them some experiential learning.
Is that one of the reasons why you decided your sort of green project would be solar panels?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. It's nice. The solar panels are like themselves are really nice, but one of the most influential outcomes of these solar panels is actually just the impact it's going to have on the kids, and it's going to make them a lot more aware and of what we can do. Oh, it's not actually some abstract, impossible thing we could do. Like fighting climate change isn't that hard to do. Really, it can be done by us, and it can show them how. Really, I think that's something that we really need to focus on a lot more these days. I find is not so much the bad stuff, but more so how we can fight these things, how we can help, and how it's not that hard, really. we just need to work together and just, yeah, get to it.
Now, obviously, you had to get some buy-in. You couldn't just single-handedly decide that, you know, Tantramar Regional High School would get solar panels. So what was your process like? How did you approach the powers that be?
Yeah, well, we started, as I said, with applying for this grant, NAFRNet Zero. So yeah, we reached out to them and with the approval of my principal and with the help of Janie Brooks as well. She kind of helped me get involved with all that. And at that time, I was really inexperienced with applying for funding and all that. So I got a lot of help from Janie at that point. And yeah, we got the application sent in, and within a few weeks, we heard back that we were selected for this funding.
So that's Janie Brooks from EOS Eco Energy?
Yep.
And your principal, I mean, so I'm assuming like right away you went to your principal, Susan Lafford, and said, you know, I want to do something with the school here.
Yeah.
So what was the reaction like from your principal?
It was really good, actually. She Susan Lafford is her name, and she was all for it at first. And I also got a lot of advice and help from two other teachers, Matthew Wheaton and Mr. John Nestor Brooks as well. And they're kind of like my little round table, I guess, at the school. And they, all three of them, are really great helps all through the process so far.
That's Josh Mullen, a grade 11 student at Tantramar Regional High School, who has secured $30,000 in funding to go towards a solar power array for his school.
Thanks to Erica Butler. And that is it for us this week. Thanks to our journalists, Adam Innes, Erica Butler, Jules Michel, Aidan Keenan, and to both our national editors, Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox, with whom we had the pleasure to talk to this week, live on air, celebrating story number 5,000, produced for